Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the show where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. My name is Barry Maxtay, and I'm joined by my co-host Ben Vanderveld. And this week is one of those episodes where we go completely against the branding of the podcast and celebrate the best of the best, which may be confusing if you've never listened to us before. So for an upbeat hour, stick with us. If you want misery and schadenfreude, then go and listen to any of the 230 other odd episodes we have in our back catalogue.
Yeah, we are going to be going against the grain this week and enjoying the splinters of high achievement rather than the smoothly sanded wood of mediocrity.
Exactly so. We are going back to some past episodes and looking not for the worst in those topics, but instead what we consider the best. And we have gone to episodes 71 to 75, where we talked about the world's worst elected head of government with Nat Tapley, about the world's worst tourist attraction with Camilla Whitehill, about the world's worst quiz contestant with Lydia Mizen, about the world's worst knight with Paul Duncan McGarrity, and we talked about the world's worst sex scene with playwright Tristan Bernays. There's some doozies in there. Can't wait till we get to number 75. But we're going to start off with the world's best elected head of government. Now, our world's worst we selected, I seem to remember, was Sapir Murat Niyazov, the president of Turkmenistan.
With the words democratically elected doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Yeah. And so, Ben, what have you decided upon for your world's best elected? I mean, Ben and I, just off mic, before we started recording, kind of agreed that when it comes to elected heads of government, it always is a, oh, they'll do kind of result when it comes to elections.
Honestly, I found it so hard, and I don't want to seem like I'm being a tedious, whining blowhard, but I mean, what's the best elected head this country we live in has had, if I'm looking at things from a progressive, warm, kind point of view? I mean, it's Clement Attlee, isn't it?
He set up the NHS. That's my choice. It's Clement Attlee.
Brilliant. I mean, if it's not Clement Attlee, then looking at the world right now, it's Jacinda Ardern, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or alternatively, ultimately the new Finnish Prime Minister, Sanna Marin, and I'm picking her because A, she's the youngest in world history, B, she's a woman, and C, she hasn't been in the role for long, so she can't have done much harm.
I like, speaking of Prime Ministers who've not been in the job for long, the new Swedish Prime Minister, Sweden's first female Prime Minister, who resigned after 12 hours and is now back as their Prime Minister.
Oh, why did they resign?
Magdalena Andersson is her name. She was in a coalition and there were disagreements about one aspect of their budget, I think, they were passing in the first session of Parliament, and the Green Party left the coalition, so the government had to resign, or she had to resign as Prime Minister, and now she's been elected again with basically the same people voting for her, but the Greens now not part of a coalition, but supporting.
This sort of seems like the electorate are essentially going, don't make us force you to be Prime Minister.
Yes. Yeah, but Jacinda Ardern is one of those people who, if you're, I think it's always the case, you look at heads of government in other countries who seem lovely with rose-tinted glasses, and then there are people who live in those countries who are like, oh no, but this, and this. And Jacinda Ardern is one of those who just the rest of us around the world look at so longingly, and New Zealand, if you ever turn your backs for too long, we will all steal her.
Yeah, I think the difference is that there's what's your man in charge of Canada right now?
Justin Trudeau.
Yeah, who obviously, you know, he's good looking, he's intelligent, he has appointed good people to his cabinet, he's from a warm progressive dynasty, he talks a good game and was good at first, but then you speak to Canadians and they're like, yeah, but it is a bit in the pocket of big oil and there's a bit of sneaky backhanded arms dealing as well. So there's only, yeah. but then I sort of feel like if we're picking this, we've got to set our bars low, don't we?
Yeah. The bar has been set so low by so many recent elections around the world.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you have a different political outlook to me or Barry in England, you might go, well, Disraeli and Gladstone, just because, you know, they were such hefty titans of the 19th century. Or you might pick Margaret Thatcher if you're wrong. But, you know, I understand she is totemic as the first zombie head of state in this country. It's an almost impossible choice. I'm not an anarchist. I accept that you have to have some sort of state and some sort of government. And there are people who it's easy to bash who have done well. Like Tony Blair was a perfectly good prime minister up until September the 12th, 2001. And then he made some catastrophic decisions. What about Ireland? Has Ireland had any good prime ministers?
Well, some. Yeah, Sean Lamass would be widely regarded as maybe Ireland's best Taoiseach or prime minister because he helped introduce an industrial revolution in Ireland in the 60s, invited a lot of foreign direct investment and things like that, which helped rejuvenate the country and set it on the way towards a net immigration rather than emigration, which we hit in the 90s. But we've had a lot of chancellors and back dealers and, you know, people very trenchantly allied to the church and to very hardline social attitudes and things like that. And people would look at Leo Varadkar and say, yay, a gay prime minister, how lucky Ireland is. But also, as a lefty, not my favourite person in the world. Me as a lefty, not him as a lefty. Him definitely not lefty.
Yeah, it is. I might be wrong, but it does feel certainly in Anglo-Irish politics that you're like, yay, gay politicians, boo, you're irritatingly centre-right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Jacinda Ardern is really good. And there was a good article about her at the weekend, actually, in The Guardian, or late last week, where it talked about how she, just as the sort of person who, when there's a crisis, steps up in the most perfect response with the Christchurch massacre and with the eruption of that volcano and through COVID, she's just immediately on the ball. She communicates clearly. There's a humanity to how she acts and the way she tries to connect with people at the centre of tragedies. Takes direct responses. There was the immediate gun reforms and there was an international sort of coalition she's tried to set up to stamp out extremism online and all of these things. You know, it's not a, oh, this must never happen again, hopes and prayers sorts of thing. And with countries around the world, the government sort of suffering in terms of poll numbers through COVID, she's kind of maintained a pretty decent number and won re-election during COVID. So, you know.
Yeah, such a rarity of just being a, I mean, to say normal human is unfair because she is remarkable because she's done all of that with a baby on her hip. And
maybe the baby's the mastermind.
Oh yeah, yeah, maybe like that tiny little alien inside the man in Man in Black.
Yeah.
it is one of those things. Out now, I have to phrase this very carefully. You often see pictures and news stories of female politicians bringing a baby into the chamber and taking their part in the democratic process whilst nursing a baby. Tremendous. Bringing a baby to the workplace, that workplace accepting you and you doing the job is remarkable. But Jacinda Ardern is taking the piss, frankly, because she's doing it on such a higher level of difficulty, isn't she?
Yeah, through COVID and running the country.
Yeah, did she bring her baby to the United Nations when the baby was very young? I seem to remember.
Oh, I think it made a keynote speech, didn't it?
Yes, yes. Okay, well, fair enough. I think we both agreed that Jacinda Ardern's baby is the best democratically elected leader.
Shall I chat briefly about Clement Attlee, because Attlee was my choice as
Go
well.
For it.
Yeah, Attlee. For people who don't know, Attlee was the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom immediately after World War II, won election against Winston Churchill. And I think sort of Churchill is the name, if you're not from the UK, that people go, oh, greatest British Prime Minister, led Britain through the war. Immediately lost an election at the end of the war.
It's really, apparently that's not a particularly rare electoral trend.
Mm. But it's just interesting to demonstrate how people go, oh, he must have been, he's a brilliant leader and must have been extremely popular. No, as soon as the war was over, people went, no, we need someone who actually will revitalise the country. It's not about international matters anymore. And Churchill had this to say about Attlee. He said he was a modest man with much to be modest about, though he did grow to show a lot of admiration for him. Attlee worked as a community organiser in Stepney, which was at that time a very poor slum area of London. And so he brought that experience to the Labour Party, and to, they were in the coalition during the war as the sort of the national unity government. And they had a pretty big role to play. There was, you know, in late 1940, the Conservatives were, you know, looking for who was going to be the Prime Minister. Was it going to be Churchill? Was it going to be Halifax? And Lord Halifax was not the biggest fan of the idea of fighting Hitler. He kind of wanted to continue the idea of appeasement, thought there was a deal to be made with Hitler, with Mussolini acting as the mediator. And there were quite a lot of Conservative MPs who kind of agreed with that. Had it not been for Attlee's very stridently anti Nazi outlook. And indeed, you know, he wasn't particularly pro-Soviet. A lot of people at the time thought, if you're a socialist, you must be a fan of Soviet Russia and communism. But Attlee led Labour to also support Churchill to be prime minister. So without their support, we might have ended up with a very different ending to the story of World War II. And he also insisted, when Churchill and Roosevelt were negotiating the Atlantic Charter, this was where they decided on the official aims of World War II and what the outcomes of the war should be. It was Attlee who insisted that they have freedom from want as one of the goals at the end of it, which led to all sorts of things like the Marshall Plan and all of the labour reforms after World War II as well.
I mean, honestly, the woke virtue signalling arsehole.
The most famous thing, of course, is most people know Attlee for his helping to found the National Health Service through the NHS Act of 1946, made healthcare free on the basis of citizenship and need rather than payment of fees or insurance. And they also passed the National Insurance Act the same year, which introduced Social Security, meaning you pay a weekly contribution from your wages and return a wide range of benefits would come your way when you couldn't work.
Yeah, I mean, all that he wants us to do is just leech off the state, become welfare scum. The more I hear of this guy, the more I don't like him.
He was also Prime Minister during the independence of India and Ireland declaring itself a republic.
Just letting our empire slip through our fingers.
Yeah, absolutely. Establishing the childcare service through the Children Act, the Town and Country Planning Act, allowing new towns, land development being subject to planning permission.
Okay, so encouraging overpopulation, like taking the child workforce out of factories.
And the National Parks and Access to the Countryside Act, allowing the creation of national parks and areas of outstanding natural beauty in England and Wales. He died in 1967. There have been several surveys by Ipsos Mori and the University of Leeds in 2004, 2010, and 2016, all of which declared him the most successful British Prime Minister of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
There will have been downsides. There was a lot of post-war austerity. To be fair, given that Churchill thought that Labour's reforms would need, and I quote, some kind of Gestapo, I think Attlee did pretty well.
Oh, Winston.
So what are we gonna hit on? Are we gonna hit on Attlee? Or are we gonna hit on Jacinda Ardern?
I mean, listen, I have failed in my job to adequately research Jacinda Ardern because literally, I tried for about half an hour to do this, and it just made me sad and angry at the dearth of talent that we've elected.
Well, let's go with the route one, long ball from the back choice of Clement Attlee as a. One of the heads of government who heads of government today could take a long, hard look at and learn a lesson or two from.
That's very fair. And I think, do you know what, if you are that invested in the democratic process and you are from a country that isn't New Zealand, Britain or Ireland, and you have a good democratically elected leader now or in the past, please do let us know. Because it'd be nice to hear of people who aren't shite hawks.
Yeah. In episode 72, we talked to playwright Camilla Whitehill about the world's worst tourist attraction, and in between shrines that smelt of farts and islands full of ghosts, we hit upon the hellscape that is the capitalist dream of Madame Tussauds, brackets, and M&M's world, which Ben slipped in at the end of the episode.
Oh yeah.
The problem with so many brilliant tourist attractions in my eyes is that they're always really busy. A bit of me wanted to suggest the entire country of Italy as the world's best tourist attraction, because goddammit, I love a castle and an amphitheatre, and I would happily spend several months off of work just travelling around to finding ruined villas and mosaics to look at. But you know, Venice has a problem with cruise ships arriving and just dumping thousands of people on the streets, and it's always busy. The Eiffel Tower, you have to queue to get into. I've been to the Statue of Liberty, you got to go on the ferry and it's really busy. It's beautiful, but you got to go on the ferry and it's busy. And I'm not someone who likes crowds. So I thought, what's a tourist attraction you can go to where you don't have to worry so much about the crowds? And so I have hit upon the Aurora. Aurora Borealis and Aurora Australis. The most beautiful natural tourist attraction, I think, in the world.
I mean, you don't have to pay for entry.
You can go anywhere across a very long strip of the Earth's surface. There are recommended places to view the Aurora Borealis in the Northern Hemisphere, for example. Tromsø is widely regarded as one of the best cities to see it in. It's got more pubs and bars per capita than anywhere else in Norway, and you can just stumble outside and watch the aurora to your heart's content. But you can also go somewhere more remote like Lapland, where you can go to ice hotels, very sparsely populated, Reykjavik, and Ilulissat, which is Greenland's third largest city with a population of just 5,000 people. So if you want sparsely populated and not a lot of light pollution and beautiful outdoor pursuits and stark landscapes, then those are the places to go and see it. It's one of those things, they're not fully sure exactly why different types of auroras happen, but basically it involves the interaction between the solar wind and the Earth's magnetosphere.
Nonsense. It is the impact created by Doctor Strange fighting off the Chitauri.
And it comes from the name of the Roman goddess Aurora, who is the traveled from east to west, announcing the coming of the sun.
Is Aurora the goddess of middle-class child names?
Or dithering, or yeah. Or most auroras occur in a band known as the auroral zone, which is typically 3 to 6 degrees wide in latitude and between 10 to 20 degrees from the poles, northern and southern poles. You get them on different planets as well. There are auroras on Saturn and on Jupiter. The first ever extrasolar auroras, so outside of our solar system, were discovered in July 2015 over the brown dwarf star LSR J1835+3259. Actually named, and it was red, found to be a million times brighter than the northern lights.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Apparently it was the result of charged particles interacting with hydrogen in the atmosphere of this particular star. Or one of the theories is that the stellar winds may have been literally stripping materials from the surfaces of the brown dwarf and producing their own electrons. Or that another body around the star, another moon or something, is throwing off materials, which is what happens on Jupiter. The Io rips bits of Jupiter off. And there's really interesting histories of auroras as well. In 2000 BC, according to legend, a young woman named Fu Bao in China was sitting alone by a bay, and a band of magical light appeared like moving clouds and flowing waters, turning into a bright halo around the Big Dipper and illuminated the earth and made all these beautiful shapes and shadows. And she was so moved that she became pregnant and gave birth to a son who became the Emperor Xuan Huan, legendary initiator of Chinese culture. He's considered the ancestor of all Chinese people. So all Chinese people are descended from the aurora, apparently.
So what you're saying is that the aurora is in some way responsible for the pandemic. Not that I'm holding all Chinese people responsible for the pandemic, obviously, but surely some of them are responsible.
If you subscribe to said theory, then yes, the aurora is the reason we have COVID. Why do I feel like I've stumbled onto a 4chan message board?
Just domino theory, mate. Standard domino theory.
And one other story I really like, a Native American story. The European explorer Samuel Hearn recorded the views of the Chippe Yuan Dene, who were a tribe, and they thought that when you stroke caribou fur, it looks like there's sparks coming off it. And so the Dene made the link between the caribou and the aurora. And so they believe that the lights in the sky that they could see are the spirits of their departed friends dancing in the sky, presumably dancing with caribou. There's a reindeer disco going on in the sky. You see the aurora borealis.
Okay,
that's science, Ben. That's science.
That is. I think Reindeer Disco is a band I saw opening the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury
almost
2018.
Certainly. And finally, the last Aurora I want to visit is Steve.
Steve the Aurora?
Steve the Aurora. Steve. It's a purple-white ribbon in the sky. First reported in 2016. 50 citizen scientists observed it. It's called STEVE because it stands for Strong Thermal Emission Velocity Enhancement.
Well, I'm going to tell every person I've ever met called Steve about that.
Yeah, technically, apparently it's not an aurora, but it looks very much like them. It's caused by hot plasma at an altitude of 450 kilometres. But Steve Aurora, as a tourist attraction, there's nothing quite like being reminded of how tiny and insignificant your planet is. And how amazing the world is in the pure silence. That's that unique silence you get when you're standing in the midst of a snowy landscape, which you can't really get anywhere else.
Listen, if I need to experience the bleak tundra, snowy silence and an appreciation of how small I am, I just need to try out some new material at the Chuckle Dungeon on a Tuesday night. Right, very good. Well, for mine, I had a big think about my favourite thing that I visited ever as a tourist, and I think it's a cathedral, which feels very off-brand for me. It is the Sagrada Familia, which is, of course, the cathedral built by Gaudi. Well, not built by Gaudi, famously not built by Gaudi. Famously designed by Gaudi and still not yet built. And for those that don't know, the Sagrada Familia literally translates as the Spanish version of the Adams family. And each of the spires in it represents a different character in the Adams family. So you've got the main one, which is the Gomez spire. And then sort of next to it is Morticia. But yeah, there's a remarkable aerial shot of Barcelona that I've seen taken, has done the rounds on social media. And because Barcelona is on a grid system, it is literally like tenement flat, tenement flat, tenement flat, tenement flat, UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's honestly mind-buggeringly remarkable. Not least because you have, there's the side exit that I've been to, which is this, seems like quite traditional celebration of creation. There's a tortoise on the bottom of one arch and a turtle on the bottom of the other, which apparently represent both the earth and the sea. I think they represent the Discworld. And and then obviously there's much more modernist bits on the inside that represent sort of the way organic trees are grown. There's the frontispiece representing the different stations of the cross. It's so madly ambitious. And to be fair, there are so many medieval cathedrals that were designed and built over the period of many people's lifetimes, and it's not an uncommon thing to have the religious version of planting seeds that your grandchildren will see grow into oak trees, but to have that still in our lifetime is something else. And I remember going to visit it 5-6 years ago and being overawed by this sense of what a absolutely remarkable monument to something that almost certainly isn't true.
Do you know what is fascinating? If you go on its Wikipedia page, there's a bit where it tells you what its construction status is.
Yeah, at the moment it is estimated to be completed in 2026.
Well, there's some decorative bits that won't be finished for a few years after that. But yeah, the
builders' quotes, they're always off, aren't they?
But there's a picture beside it. There's a model of the cathedral. It's in white and brown, and the brown bits are the bits that are still to be built.
So
you've got like all these bits of spires that are brown and bits that are built. It's going to be amazing, and there's still so much still to do. It was in the news actually today. I don't know if you saw.
Oh no, I didn't.
There's a big 12-pointed star which has been stuck on it for Christmas on one of the towers of the Sagrada Familia, which is 7 meters point to point and weighs 5.5 tons. And has been described by Salvador Barroso, a spokesman for two local groups, as aesthetically horrible.
Fair. I like that he's not mincing his words.
Yeah, it's going to be lit on the 8th of December.
Oh, imagine if they burn it down. That's so frustrating. So it's currently, the project began in 1882. A mere 44 years later, Gaudi checked out of this mortal coil. Hopefully it might be completed on the centenary of his death.
Further breaking news, I've just scrolled down in this article about the star. They're suggesting that they've abandoned the 2026 completion date because of the pandemic.
And I bet they'll be going, it's an act of God, and they should be they should be praying to God, it's your own time you're wasting, big man.
Yeah.
To give you a notion of comparative lengths of time of some things that have been built, by the time Sagrada Familia is completed, it will have taken longer to build than the pyramids and only 50 years less than the Great Wall of China.
Wow.
Good, right? Some of the stuff that Gaudi put in, obviously Gaudi loved trying to emulate structures in nature. So he hung a weighted string from the ceiling to see how natural arches would form and designed it based on that. Also, the way the pillars inside are made, he's made them to be like trees, and in the way that the way light hits trees, it'll alter your perception of them. It really is stunning. When completed, it will be the tallest religious building in Europe. The central tower in the middle will reach 170 metres tall. But Gaudi believed that nothing man-made should ever be higher than God's work. So it is actually going to be only 1 metre less tall than the mountain in Barcelona, which is the city's highest point. That mountain is called Montjuïc, Do you know what that translates as?
Is it something like Mountain Hill or something?
Oh, no. Montjuic is the Hill of Jews.
Oh, cool.
I am led to believe. Yeah.
Is it several Jews stacked up on top of each other wearing a very long mountain-coloured trench coat?
Yeah. Yeah, it is the remains of a medieval Jewish cemetery have been found there. I like the fact he's gone, my work should be no taller than the work of God. And the Jews are like, one step ahead of you, mate. And my last little thing about Gaudi is, Gaudi died in 1926. He is buried in Sagrada Familia. The tomb is surrounded by four chapels, each dedicated to a different figure. And his is dedicated to the Carmen Virgin. He died not quietly in his home, surrounded by his loved ones, as one would expect a humble and talented servant of the Lord would be, but instead was run over by a tram, which, I don't know, there's something about that that makes me think that if God does exist, he's rather ungrateful.
Did he not expect the tram to be on time?
Lovely.
Undoubtedly, it's one of those places I really, really want to visit, the Sagrada Familia, so I'm very happy to declare that the world's greatest tourist attraction.
I mean, I've a rule for all like museums that we go to that like an hour and a half and out, no matter if I'm enjoying it, you know, get in, get out, have a bit to savor afterwards. But I had to be dragged away from Sagrada Familia. It was just stunning.
In episode 73, we talked to Lydia Meissen, erstwhile winner of the TV show Only Connect and current QI Elf, about the world's worst quiz contestant. And our dubious winner that day was John Cooper, a Welsh serial killer who was arrested after his appearance on the game show Bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, now you texted me yesterday saying you thought there was a fairly strong online consensus for who the world's greatest quiz contestant is. So how about you?
So I looked up who is the most successful game show contestant of all time. And the answer is Kenneth Wayne Jennings III. He is the undisputed champion of Jeopardy. Can you tell me how long you think his winning streak was?
I happen to know this because it's one of those like trivia things that came up. It's 74 consecutive wins.
Yeah, he won just over $4.5 million in doing so. He has the record for the highest average correct responses per game of 35.9 in his original run and 33.1 overall, including tournaments and special events. No one else has exceeded 30, which is just, he is just out of this world. His gross earnings also include various other tournaments and various champions, my favourite of which was in 2011 when he won second place in Jeopardy's IBM challenge when he lost to the Watson computer.
Yeah.
Which is just remarkable. He is a Mormon, so well done the Church of the Latter-day Saints. It turns out that you are remarkable at trivia, but very, very poor at identifying empirical truth. And one of my favorite things about him, he almost didn't make it past his first episode. So
yeah.
His final Jeopardy answer was, she's the first female track and field athlete to win medals in five different events at a single Olympics. And his response was, who is Jones? Now, the answer is, who is Marion Jones?
Marion Jones.
But yeah. Host Alex Trebek was like, no, we'll let that go. Like Brian Lara being dropped on 10 before going on to score 501.
Yeah.
He then went on to win 74 in a row, over 182 calendar days.
Yeah.
The answer the final lost to was, most of this firm's 70,000 seasonal white-collar employees work only 4 months a year. He answered, what is FedEx? But he was defeated by Nancy Zirk, who said, what is H&R Block? Brilliantly, H&R Block, who are a tax planning and financial service, offered Jennings free tax planning services for the rest of his life, saying that they reckon he owed about $1.04 million in taxes on his winnings. Even better, there was an advert for FedEx in USA Today 3 days later saying, there's only one time FedEx has ever been the wrong answer. Congratulations, Jennings.
Wow. That's great.
And he has gone on, he narrated Alex Trebek's autobiography, The Answer Is, and was nominated for a Grammy for Best Spoken Word. And, as I'm sure you know, now has taken his mantle and presents the show with Mayim Bialik. So
yeah, he's really made Jeopardy. He's definitely the king of Jeopardy. Though, actually, I have to sort of footnote something you said earlier on. He hasn't won the most money of anyone ever on Jeopardy, because he is the highest earning quiz show contestant in American history, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, there's a chap called Brad Rutter, who's the guy who came third in that IBM challenge.
Yes.
He actually has won more money on Jeopardy.
Oh, has he?
But Ken Jennings has... They sort of keep trading places at the top of the game show contestants who've won the most money. Jennings has also won some money on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Brad Rutter's won some money on Million Dollar Mind Game. So I think there's only, I say only, $100,000 between them at the moment at the top of the total winnings. But yeah, certainly that streak of Ken Jennings is remarkable. Yeah, he definitely is one of those who comes up a lot on the lists. But for people who are looking a little bit closer to home in the UK, let me present Kevin Ashman. Kevin will be known to anyone who's watched the TV show Eggheads, which has been on our screens for about 18 years now. There's five quizzing experts who are basically called the greatest quiz show team in the country, and five members of the public come together with their own quiz show team, and they each get pitted head-to-head against a member of the Eggheads, and if you get more questions out of five right than an Egghead, you knock the Egghead out. And if the Eggheads get more questions right than your contestant, they get knocked out. And then at the end, you have a head-to-head where maybe there's only one of your team left against all of the Eggheads. They're all formidable, formidable quizzes, but Kevin is maybe the greatest of them all. He won the Great Quiz Show 15-1 in 1989 and returned to win their Millennium Edition between all their past champions in 1999. He won Mastermind on British TV in 1995, scoring a record 41 points with no passes in his heat. Is insane. His special subject on that show was the life and work of Martin King Jr. He also became champion after winning in the final with the subject The Zulu War. And in 2006, he appeared at the final of the Junior Mastermind version, encouraging a young contestant who'd also chosen The Zulu Wars as his final subject. In 1996, he won Brain of Britain, which is a fiendishly tricky quiz show on BBC Radio 4, scoring 38 in his semi-final, which remains the highest individual score ever made on the show. He also went on to win Brain of Brains, contested between the previous 3 years Brains of Britain, and Top Brain, contested every 9 years between the previous three Brain of Brains. And he also twice won Master Brain, a radio competition for winners and runners-up of Mastermind and Brain of Britain. He has also won on Sale of the Century, Screen Test, Quiz Night, Trivial Pursuit, and the Great British Quiz. And as I said, from 2003, he's been a member of the Eggheads. And between 2002 and 2006, he wrote the questions for Brain of Britain on Radio 4. So he's one of those quiz show contestants who's graduated to actually setting the quiz for the people who come after him. But not only is he so brilliant on TV, but he is also ranked the world and European number one quiz contestant.
So I follow Paul Sinner on Facebook,
yes,
because obviously I've worked with him a bit and know him a bit. He has a remarkable brain. But when he talks about this guy, it is with such reverence, you know, like Kasparov speaking about the current grandmaster of chess.
His record at international quizzing level is outrageous. He has 17 gold medals, 13 silver medals, and 3 bronze medals from British, European, and World Championships. He has won the British Quiz Championships 7 times. In 2004, he won the World Quizzing Championships individual competition, a title he has won 6 times in total, and is still going strong in his 60s. It is incredible what he does, and he is always the contestant that people on Eggheads want to avoid the most.
A remarkable brain, remarkable recall, maybe an eidetic memory, but it's also the ability to keep up that standard show, like competition after competition. And I've heard Paul talk about the Quizzing World Championships. It's not like a massive game of Eggheads or a massive pub quiz. It is essentially an exam.
Yeah.
But he's really good at exams.
It's just great to see nerds be successful and brilliant. As former nerds, it's nice to see people who go on to hang on to their nerdhood. Former and current nerds.
There we are.
It's great to see other nerds be celebrated for just being nerds. And so I don't know who to pick.
I think we got to go for your guy just because there's a purity about it. Because it's not, I mean, I'm sure there is prize money, but I sort of went down the monetary route.
Yes.
You were very much gone for the valedictory choice, so I'm happy.
I wonder what the monetary value of all Kevin's medals is compared to Ken Jennings's actual millions and millions of dollars.
Also, he's the sort of person who, like, in previous eras, I feel like the CIA would be kind of like, yeah, we'll have your brain. That feels like a useful asset.
In episode 74, we talked to good friend of the show, Paul Duncan McGarrity, about the world's worst night, and we hit upon the brilliant Sir George Reresby Sitwell, father of Edith Sitwell and inventor of the wasp gun. But I thought I might look at the animal kingdom.
To be honest, Barry, I thought that was going to be your solution for the next topic.
the sex scene one.
Yeah.
Well, I remembered when we did World's Worst Saint, you mentioned Saint Guinefort, who was a greyhound who a French knight owned, and the knight came home and walked into his son's nursery and found Guinefort covered in blood and thought the greyhound had eaten his son, and so killed the dog, and then heard his son crying and found him under the cot with a dead snake, and so actually Guinefort had killed the snake and saved the baby. So the knight immediately erected a shrine to Guinefort, and there were miracles apparently that happened, and the Catholic Church absolutely hated this and spent hundreds of years trying to get people to stop calling the dog Saint Guinefort. And then obviously there's things like the Dickin Medal, which is basically the animal Victoria Cross in the UK. So you have animals like William of Orange, who was a messenger pigeon who carried messages during World War II. William particularly brought a message back to home base during the Battle of Arnhem, a message that's credited with saving the lives of 2,000 British soldiers.
Wow.
So, remarkable. But he's not a knight.
I've got a funny idea. I know where you're going with this, but do continue.
However, Niels Olav
is
a king. A king who is also a knight. Tell the listeners what Niels Olav is, Ben.
Oh, that is a tremendous, sneaky little cryptic pub quiz. Which king of Norway is also a knight? Niels Olav is a king penguin.
He is indeed. Niels Olav is a king penguin who resides in Edinburgh Zoo, and the Norwegian King's Guard visited the Edinburgh Military Tattoo in 1961 for a display of drill, and there was a Norwegian lieutenant named Niels Egelin who became interested in the zoo in Edinburgh's penguin colony. And then the King's Guard returned in 1972, and Egelin was with them, and he arranged for the regiment to adopt a penguin. And this penguin was named Niels Olav in honour of Niels himself and King Olav V of Norway.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was initially given the rank of Vice Corporal or Lance Corporal. And he has been promoted every time since then that the King's Guard has returned to the zoo. In 1982, he was made Corporal, promoted to Sergeant in 1987. Then Niels Olav died in 1987. And much like Lassie and Rin Tin Tin or Shamu, they've just replaced him. Niels Olav II then was a near double in terms of his looks. He was 2 years old at the time. He was promoted in 1993 to Regimental Sergeant Major, in 2001 to Honourable Regimental Sergeant Major, and in 2005, Colonel in Chief, during which visit a statue of Niels Olav was presented to the zoo, and there's a sister statue of it in Oslo. And then in 2008 came the knighthood. A knighthood approved by King Harald V. Wikipedia's article here, slightly unnecessarily, I feel, says Niels was the first penguin to receive such an honour in the Norwegian army.
Listen, you know what? It's always nice to have those things clarified.
There was a ceremony in front of several hundred people. 130 guardsmen were on parade at the zoo. A citation from the current King of Norway, Harald V, was read out, describing Niels as a penguin in every way qualified to receive the honour and dignity of knighthood. And I bet you have seen the photo, Ben, of the penguin receiving the guard of honour. It is the most... such a perfect photo of feet... A line of feet of soldiers and a penguin walking, waddling along with its head turned up, looking at them.
I mean, penguins are an animal that are made for a royal parade. It wouldn't work so well if it was a giraffe.
Yeah.
Or I'm trying to think the most, like a hyena skulking down. I don't know what a hyena is doing in Norway.
Yeah. Well, a third penguin, Nils Olav, has taken over since then. So obviously the knighthood is hereditary.
Can I just ask, is the penguin Nils Olav the Norwegian version of Trigger's broom?
Yes, it must be. Yeah, it's the same penguin, or different penguin, but it keeps the same rank. In fact, in 2016, he was promoted to brigadier in another ceremony. And Nils Olav, Brigadier Nils Olav III, now outranks Nils Egelian, the lieutenant who first proposed that they should adopt a penguin.
Like, you know when you read stuff, so obviously I'm going down the wormhole of the Beatles documentary, and the worst thing you can do is Google how old the Beatles were when they did certain things, and like, bloody hell, I'm 38 years old. By the time he was 25, McCartney had written Sergeant Pepper. But it's almost worse to find out that I am outranked by several penguins.
In Norway, they tend to refer to Nils Olav as a mascot, but he is technically Sir Nils Olav, Brigadier in the Norwegian Army. And in fact, his Wikipedia page has a great, you know, the way you find, look up military figures on Wikipedia, it has like their military career in the little sidebar right at the top of the page. It has here, military career, allegiance, Norway, service/branch, Norwegian Army, years of service, rank, unit.
Yeah.
It's got the whole lot.
I mean, in terms of like battlefield kills, just the amount of fish that he must have caught, like he must be stacking it up.
Exactly. So American sniper, eat your heart out. Nils Olav is coming for you.
Very good. So I went down the route of looking for people with the surname Knight rather than going all chivalric. And I found a fascinating man from the American South who I have never, ever heard of before. And this is Newton Knight. In 1861, Mississippi seceded from the Union because the state, and I am quoting from a document issued by it, thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery. Good work, Mississippi. Newton Knight was a poor farmer who did not own any slaves, but it seemed he didn't support slavery at all and was not keen in going to war to defend it. In particular, what he didn't like was the 20 Negro law, and what that meant was that anyone who owned 20 or more slaves could sit out the war. And as one of Knight's friends put it, this was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight. So he objected both on racial grounds, more of which in a moment, but also on class grounds. Obviously high stakes, I suppose it doesn't really need saying. But not only could he suffer social opprobrium for this, but he could have been executed for not signing up to the Confederacy. He did eventually enlist as an orderly, but nevertheless, Confederate soldiers raided his farm, stole his horses, and so in response, Newton Knight abandoned his regiment, hiked 200 miles to his home, where he encountered all sorts of government corruption and poverty and failing crops. He was arrested by the Confederacy in 1863, tortured, allegedly, and shipped back to the front lines. He deserted again as soon as he could. And at this point, over 100 of his neighbours did the same thing, and they returned to their homes in a place called Jones County. And at this point, from inside the South, along with Jones, they formed what was known as the Jones County Scouts, aka the Knights Company, and declared guerrilla warfare on the Confederacy.
Wow.
They would hide in nearby swamps and ambush them. Absolutely wonderful stuff what they would do. The company was pretty large, and Newt was an illiterate farmhand, but charismatic, great leadership skills. He was an expert with his double-barreled muzzle-loading shotgun. He would hide out in the swamps, as I said, which had nicknames like Devil's Den and Panther Creek. And they'd communicate with each other by blowing signals on their cattle horns. And unsurprisingly, they were aided by sympathetic local people, both white people and African Americans. I'm just staggered by the bravery that he showed in doing this. He apparently, this is not confirmed, sent General William T. Sherman a Declaration of Independence in 1864, claiming that the Free State of Jones, as it was known, was officially seceding from the Confederacy. This understandably angered the Confederacy, and they sent Colonel Robert Larry and 500 men to crush the Knight Company. They used savage dogs and brutal executions, and they tried their best to exterminate them, but they managed to weather the storm. And by the end of the Civil War, the Knight Company was still standing. And after the war, Knight was appointed as a US Marshal. He fought the KKK, and he continued to do what he'd done during the war and acting as, you know, a sort of Robin Hood, redistributing food to the hungry Mississippians. He did a lot during Reconstruction, which was obviously a post-emancipation era attempt to level the playing field. And he ended up marrying an ex-slave named Rachel, who had worked alongside him during the war. Apparently, Rachel was the person who inspired one of his most brutal guerrilla tactics, which was to use a mixture of red pepper and glass to combat Lowry's attack dogs.
Poor dogs, but, you know.
Yeah, they were dogs fighting on the side of the Confederacy.
Yes.
Just a remarkable, remarkable figure. He died at the age of 92 in 1922. And in spite of a Mississippi law that barred the interment of white people and black people in the same cemetery, he was buried at his request in what is now called the Knight Family Cemetery next to his wife, Rachel. And engraved on his gravestone is the epitaph, "He lived for others."
Yeah, cool.
So that is very much the tip of the iceberg on Newton Knight. I could talk a lot more about him. He seems, and again, American listeners, if you know more about this man than I do, but on the look of it, he seems a man light years ahead of his time and indescribably brave.
Yeah. Wow. Well, makes my suggestion of a fucking penguin seem a bit trivial now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. You disgust me.
Finally, in episode 75, we talked to Tristan Bernays about the world's worst sex scene. And if you recently listened to our live show from Bethnal Green, you will have heard Beth Kill recite it. We picked the sex scenes from Morrissey's List of the Lost. But yeah, Ben, how did you ruin your internet search history yesterday?
Well, first of all, I simply went for length of time. So, in Hollywood, so in a conventional movie, how long do you think the longest recorded sex scene is?
I double digits, like 12 minutes, 13 minutes?
Nope, 5 minutes, 41 seconds.
Oh, stamina, people, come
on. That has been Justin Timberlake and Mila Kunis.
What? When? Oh, was that in The Love Guru or something like
no,
that?
No, that was in Friends with Benefits.
Friends with Benefits?
Yes.
Wow.
And the shortest on Air Lovemaking?
There are sex scenes where sex didn't even happen, I know. There's some, like, no seconds?
In Juno for a whopping 6 seconds.
Oh, I see.
I just don't know how they managed it.
Teenage love, at that point, you're just finding your feet.
Yeah, absolutely. Just a couple of facts before I pick mine. Apparently, in Superbad, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, during the sex scene he had in that, he was only 17 and therefore had to have a chaperone present. That chaperone was his mother.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Oh no! I seem to remember when we did. Is that film called? Is it called The Girl Next Door with Alicia Cuthbert? And I think it's Emil Hirsch. At the time, was underage as well. So there's like a sex scene in that where he has to have a pillow over his bits to stop any chance of any contact being made.
No contact whatsoever. There's a lovely story of Ryan Reynolds talking about doing a sex scene with Olivia Wilde in The Change-Up. I like this a lot. So he says, she's sitting there, I take her top off, take a bra off, she has these panties on, but she's drawing these little adorable smiley faces on them. And I forgot every line in the scene, not just from this movie, from every movie I've ever done. At some point in the scene, she takes my hands and puts them on her breasts. I take my hands away and I look down at my hands and there are two frickin' smiley faces on them and I have no idea what to do. And I reflexively, like an idiot, just put my hands right back on her breasts. Last little thing I looked at, probably one of the most famous sexy series of our time, Game of Thrones. A staggering 82 nude scenes in it. 108 minutes of sex scenes, including 134 breasts, 60 bums, and only 7 penises.
Ugh.
Yes, but I mean, the actual male, well, the male to female balance is all right. Of the 51 stars in it who bared all, 36 are women, 15 are men, which, you know, given the standards of history, is not a terrible average.
Could do better, though, I would say.
Could do better. Who is the horniest house?
Horniest house?
Of the houses in Game of Thrones.
Lannisters. The Lannisters are the horniest.
No, they're in third. It's the Targaryens. Bit of brother on sister action.
Okay.
But for mine, I honestly, this is not just me being unadventurous or prudish. I genuinely struggle to think of a memorable sex scene that has made me go, oh, what? Like, because most of the times it's a bit sort of, let's add this perfunctory thing into an action movie. I mean, I know there's an infamous one for realism was Donald Sutherland and, is it Julie Christie in Don't Look Now?
That sounds right, yes.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's awkward and passionate and fumbling and what most sex is, apart from with me. But my favourite one, just because it's a charming way of approaching it and I really enjoy the cinematography of it, is the scene in Amelie when Amelie asks the question, how many people are having orgasms right now? And it's in Paris and it's 15 and you just get little 1 second jump cuts of men and women going, ooh, ha, ooh, ha, ooh. And it's really sweet and lovely and also honest. So that's what I've gone for, that scene from Amelie.
Very, very good.
Yes, but both a lovely choice. I think we can all agree, slightly sidestepping the social awkwardness that Barry is now going to dive into.
Oh, don't you worry. I think we mentioned about when we talked about this first time around, the first sex scene on film as such. The film known as The Kiss, 18 seconds long. Between May Irwin and John Rice, and directed by William Heiser for Edison, and it recreated a kiss from a musical that was very popular at the time called The Widow Jones. I mean, it's just a peck, basically, between Rice and May Irwin. But there were people at the time who were absolutely outraged by the idea of it. One commentator wrote, it was beastly enough in live sight on the stage, but magnified to gargantuan proportions and repeated 3 times over, it is absolutely disgusting. You can see the clip on Wikipedia. It is the most mild and slightly comedic kiss ever, because Rice is like tweezing his mustache before he does it. But there is a sex scene that I do remember, and it is very much the antithesis of what you said. It is full-on graphic, unsimulated sex from the film Short Bus by John Cameron Mitchell, who's the creator of Hedwig and the Angry Inch as well.
Oh, what a movie.
Yeah,
what a movie.
Short Bus is also, a lot of queer listeners I'm sure will know Short Bus. It's a film about, there's a lot of unsimulated sex and full-front nudity and stuff in it. Very diverse cast, and it explores questions of identity and pride and patriotism, where sex and otherness meet the anxiety of New York post 9/11. And it tries to make sex seem like a very universal thing and a way of creating connection, rather than it just being, ugh, sexy, lusty bodies. And there is a undeniably very funny sex scene between Seth, Jamie, and James, played by Jay Brannan, PJ Dubois, and Paul Dawson, a gay threesome. It jumps straight in from them on the sofa to Jamie rimming Seth. It depicts like nervousness and the awkwardness and anxiety and slightly weirdly funny bits you get during sex when you're trying to organize people. For example, Seth says, can you do that with your other hand, because I come at it from a different angle.
Yeah, it's like almost all of the sex scenes in Sex Education on Netflix are,
yeah, exactly,
like, for the similar reason.
Yeah, it's not all like slightly Vaseline lenses and breezes through lace curtains and things like that. So yeah, he gets him to adjust, and then Jamie, who is rimming Seth while Seth is sucking James's penis, Jamie starts speaking, and that makes Seth find it quite pleasurable to have a man speaking into his ass. And tells him to do more. Jamie doesn't really know what to do, so starts singing the Star Spangled Banner into Seth's backside.
Tremendous. What I'd really hope is that he then opens his mouth and it is amplified through there.
Even better, Seth, using James's penis as a microphone, joins in, and right, it jumps out to a sort of a rear window style. There's a chap who lives in the building opposite who is watching them through binoculars, who is just like wide-eyed at this image of the three of them and the sound of them. And they all sing along while masturbating and performing analingus and all of this stuff to a rousing climax, if you will. And it also sees them, you know, complain about carpet burn. The three of them are in a daisy chain where they're all performing oral sex on one another and silently and wordlessly all just rotate to the opposite direction, so they're doing it the other way around in a really quite like balletic movement, and it's just very funny.
It's all very well, but I think we all know that the best national anthem is La Marseillaise, so unless they do it to that.
Well, when he does get to, you know, the bit where they always do the sort of the slightly showy, the land of the free, they'll put in ornamentation if you're seeing someone singing before a baseball match or something like that. He does, at the land of the free. I hope that reads on the podcast as he just keeps detaching and reattaching his mouth. And the thing I love about this, it is funny and thoughtful and awkward and doesn't look like porn, even though there are three completely naked and erect men actually having sex with one another. It somehow makes it look more complex. It doesn't look like porn in any way, shape or form. It's tentative and joyful and feels very real. And the fact that it brings the national anthem of America, notoriously a country that has struggled, as many countries have, with its relationship with homosexuality, and brings that national anthem and the anxiety of 9/11, and you still have Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and people saying that we cause floods, and no gay marriage and all of that stuff at this point, and puts that in the middle of a gay threesome, literally being sung into another man's ass, which somehow even feels more subversive than it just being gay sex, which would penetrative sex of that kind is can look a bit heteronormative still. The fact it puts it into that just makes it, elevates it to something even more brilliant, I think.
It feels like the logical endpoint of Jimi Hendrix's version of the Star Spangled Banner. I just think that Star Spangled Banner is a remarkable euphemism for the state of someone's arsehole at the end of anal sex.
We're going to have to put an explicit rating on this for iTunes.
I think so, probably, yeah. It's like, why, hey, Jeremy, why are you sitting down awkwardly? Oh, I've got a bit of a star-spangled banger. Me and Thomas were really going at it last night. Got to the third verse.
Yeah, that's why they call me the home of the brave.
Well, I think we found a winner, haven't we?
Yes! Oh, so happy. Thank you, everyone, as ever, for listening to Worst Foot Forward. It's nice to do these episodes where we go back and talk about topics we haven't touched on for 150-odd episodes or so. We hope you found fun and facts and trivia among them. And we'll see you next week for a more regular episode. So, all together, God save our grave. Bye.